Chief political correspondent of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, David Crowe, has spent the last 12 months working on a book about the vicious infighting within the Liberal Party, which saw off two prime ministers, Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull. Venom, Vendettas, Betrayals and the Price of Power is out this week, and I can tell you it's a cracking read. David joined me for this Please Explain extra as the book was launched. David Crowe, thank you for joining this special episode of Please Explain.
Thank you, Tori.
You're currently on your book tour to promote Venom, Vendettas, Betrayals and the Price of Power, which was released this week. Tell me what it's about.
Well, it's about a period in Australian political life where we saw a level of, bastardry, brutality, some lies and deception on a scale that we hadn't seen for some time. Leadership spills have been happening for time immemorial, but they reached an intensity in the last couple of years that really was, I think, a bit new. And I think it deserved a full explanation and a full analysis, where I wanted to write a book explaining the context of everything, going back to the fall of Tony Abbott. Because, of course, when I talked to cabinet ministers about these events, they said, look, you've really got to go back to the challenge against Tony Abbott to see everything in context. So that's what I've done. And my objective was to pin down who did what, when, why they did it, what's their motivation, how do they explain themselves later, to put it all in context, because it was such an extraordinary time, but it also says something about the way politics is in Australia today, that everybody, I think, senses that frustration about the way politics is conducted.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, likes to talk about these events as ancient history, like they happened, you know, decades ago. But what struck me in reading the book this weekend is how fresh it all feels. You start in January of 2015, when Tony Abbott was really starting to make some missteps, characterised acutely by him giving a knighthood to Prince Philip. Why did that feel like the right place to start?
Because when I talk to people about what happened in 2017 and 2018, the point made to me by insiders was, really, when you've got an empty chair spill against a sitting prime minister in his first term, that's pretty extraordinary. And a lot of the bad blood began around then. Look, some of these feuds go back a decade, because we know that Tony Abbott toppled Malcolm Turnbull as leader in 2009 when they were in opposition. But that empty chair was extraordinary. Tony Abbott in his first term, people still remember the reaction that they got when they learnt about the knighthood for Prince Philip. But it was the fact that there wasn't even a candidate standing up against Tony Abbott, and yet some of that party room voted for an empty chair. And so from that moment onward, you get poison in the party room, you get animosity, you get huge concern about the way in which Tony Abbott was running the show and some of the people around him, like Peter Credlin. And that was still playing out years later. And so there is an element to this story which is a revenge cycle.
So we've learned, obviously, in the time since then, that both Peter Dutton and Scott Morrison held ambitions to be Prime Minister. What stopped them from running during that empty chair phase?
Scott Morrison was approached by colleagues saying, this is the moment, can you run? Because there were people who ended up voting for Malcolm Turnbull in 2015, but actually would have preferred Scott Morrison. He turned them down at the time. It was pretty clear that the ticket to replace the Abbott government was Malcolm Turnbull as leader, Julie Bishop remaining deputy, and Scott Morrison as treasurer. So Morrison's allies knew that if they ran dead and left Abbott to his fate, that Scott Morrison was the likely treasurer. And that's exactly what happened. Scott Morrison voted for Tony Abbott, but all his allies voted for Malcolm Turnbull, knowing that they would benefit from the leadership change.
Do you think things would have turned out differently for Malcolm Turnbull if Tony Abbott had left the parliament after he lost the prime ministership?
Definitely. There's no question in my mind that everything would have been completely different. And in fact, we know, and I say in the book, you know, the efforts that were made to try to get Tony Abbott to leave, to take up a diplomatic posting such as High Commissioner in London, but it wasn't going to wash. Tony Abbott is a political person by nature. He lives politics. He wasn't going to leave the parliament for a diplomatic post. It's not who he is. Now, he was not always intent on replacing Malcolm Turnbull. There was a period where he would speak up and he'd sort of challenge Turnbull on various issues. But there was also a moment where the idea of restoring Tony Abbott to federal cabinet was on the agenda. It's something that Tony Abbott thought would work, something that others thought would work. But when it was put to Malcolm Turnbull, he dismissed it. And from that moment onward, we had a situation where Tony Abbott knew he could not return to federal cabinet under Malcolm Turnbull. He still wanted to stand up for his beliefs, and he became an opposition leader within the coalition party room.
Malcolm Turnbull likes to lay a lot of the blame of his inability to govern at Tony Abbott's feet, but also Malcolm really started his prime ministership on the back foot, didn't he? Like, have that coalition deal that he had to sign as soon as he became prime minister made it difficult for him to get any of his big agenda through, didn't it?
Yes, and I think there are implications for the country and the way government played out at that time. You know, mostly negative implications for the country, alas. But the situation is that Malcolm Turnbull took power with enormous promise and enormous popularity and then couldn't galvanise that in the right way. His popularity sank. He considered tax reforms, ended up with the company tax cut, turned down the option of the GST or state income tax and so forth, was really looking around for ideals to fight for and lost ground, lost political ground in that time. That was a time that I call a time of false promise. People had such high expectations for Malcolm Turnbull and they weren't delivered, and he had a dysfunctional party room around him.
So he went into the 2016 election campaign without a particularly strong policy agenda. You write in the book about how Labor just outgunned the coalition in that campaign on every level. What did Labor do at the time that worked so well, and what happened to that? Why weren't they able to do that in 2019?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because some of the source material for the chapter on that period came from the Liberals themselves, because they did a report on why they performed so badly in the 2016 election, and I got a copy of that report, and that's still confidential now, but you know, there are still Liberals who've never read it. But the point was, Labor were very agile with their political arguments. They were very good with social media and high tech in terms of challenging the government. The government would send letters to voters about a new mobile base station. Labor would send text messages to the same voters and match them immediately. So Labor were very quick, and I think it really worked when Bill Shorten framed Malcolm Turnbull as somebody who only stood for the big end of town with a company tax cut, and Malcolm Turnbull wrongly resisted a banking royal commission. Shorten saw the potential for that as a political issue that really hit a nerve with people, and he went hard. That's something where the government found to its cost that it had campaigned badly. And then you jump forward to 2019 and you find this fascinating situation where Labor did not learn enough lessons from its success, but the coalition certainly learned the lessons from its failure and campaigned much better 3 years later, including having a much smarter social media game, where we now have a dispute about some of the tactics that we use against Labor on social media in 2019. Almost a role reversal in terms of who campaigned better.
The other thing I think that happened is that Bill Shorten kind of clung on to that success from 2016 with that big end of town message and tried to apply the same thing to Scott Morrison, who was a very different politician and human to Malcolm Turnbull, who'd been branded Mr. Harbourside Mansion by Peter Credlin on Sky. Can't say that about Scott Morrison, can you? And so when Shorten tried to brand the changes to, you know, franking credits and superannuation as big end of town policies, it just didn't stick.
It's interesting the way they tried to brand Scott Morrison. And Scott Morrison was made fun of at some point for wearing his baseball cap and being like the backyard dad at the barbecue. Somebody said to me over the weekend, yes, but when we were out campaigning during that election, we saw a lot of blokes who looked just like Scott Morrison. So his everyman political brand actually worked. It wrong-footed Labor, But I think the big picture is, and there is still a debate about what Labor did wrong, but let's face it, Labor thrived when the government, the coalition, was weak. And as the coalition became more and more divided and weaker, Shorten and the Labor team got bolder and bolder on policy until they reached a point where they not only had the negative gearing reform, they had tax changes on trusts, a couple of other fronts, and then they went with the franking credits change. So the weaker the coalition got, the bolder Labor became until they had a tax plan that was just so big, it made them a very large target to their cost in the election.
Diving back into the vendettas and betrayals within the Liberal Party, back to the July 28, 2018 by-elections, that's where Peter Dutton really started to make noise, isn't it, about Malcolm Turnbull's leadership?
That's right. On the surface, Peter Dutton maintained that he wasn't worried about the result in Queensland. Below the surface, behind the scenes, he was very worried and he was encouraging the concern of his colleagues who knew that if that result was repeated, that they'd lose their seats. And so that becomes a very powerful factor when it's the when backbench MPs are facing a political wipeout. They'll do whatever it takes to save their own skins. And that's what we saw. And it's interesting when you look back. It was such a tightly compressed period from July 28 until around this time last year, the middle of August. It's really only 2.5 weeks or so that we saw everything change.
It was shocking, wasn't it, the way it escalated so fast?
Until you get to a point where the media, which were part of the story, let's face it, they were part of the story in the way in which the media were given misinformation or encouraged to foment discontent. The media were reporting that Peter Dutton was ready to run and he didn't deny it. And so you had a dynamic where the Morrison camp could see what was coming down the line. Turnbull was still fairly sure that Dutton could not become leader and therefore he was going to be safe. But the Morrison crew were ready for when Dutton moved.
What do you put that down to, David? You've got three powerful political leaders in Turnbull, Dutton and Morrison. They've each got their crew around them of supporters and, you know, henchmen and henchwomen. What was it about Scott Morrison's crew that made them so much more sophisticated in the way they eventually won through in that week of the two spills and sort of came up the middle?
They were a tight group, very loyal. They had been around. They all came into Parliament in 2007. Scott Morrison, Steve Irons, Stuart Robert, who's now in Cabinet, Alex Hawke, who's now a minister. They all came in 2007. They're all Christian. They would meet on Tuesday nights for prayer group, not just themselves. There'd be a wider group as well. But this was the core of the Morrison crew. They got dismissed by their colleagues as a prayer group. That was actually a phrase used to disparage them by their rivals. But I don't think it's actually... It should be a term of disparagement. Sure, they're Christian, but they're loyal to each other. They're disciplined. They're smart. They stuck together. Over the last couple of years, we've seen people peel away from Tony Abbott. We've seen people peel away from Malcolm Turnbull. The Morrison group were always disciplined and loyal to each other. And that really shone through in that week of turmoil because the Dutton squad were a much messier group. They were kind of allies of convenience. They were all on the conservative side of the party. But we also saw that some of them were inexperienced. If you think about the people who picked up the petition to demand a meeting and then they walked the corridors of Parliament House to demand a meeting to get rid of Malcolm Turnbull, some of them had just a couple of years of experience in Parliament. Some of them were new to the place. And I think that became apparent as they messed up their own coup.
There's always blood on the floor and the walls of the party room when these things happen, when prime ministers get knived. But this one seemed to be particularly bloody, didn't it? I mean, there were many casualties. Peter Dutton was a casualty. I mean, he's obviously returned to cabinet, but his position as a potential future prime minister is pretty much gone. Tony Abbott ended up being a casualty in that he lost his seat in the election. Matthias Cormann was certainly wounded, maybe not mortally. There was a lot of blood. Do you put that down to the inexperience of some of the players?
Yes, I do. I think that they were proven to be politically incompetent in the end. That's on them. They are vindicated, or they claim vindication, because in the end the coalition won under Morrison. But let's face it, that was not their intention. They would have laughed at the prospect of Morrison as Prime Minister, say, 13 months ago. But they can now look at victory because Morrison won instead of Dutton. But I think it does change the dynamic within those ranks, because everybody has to live with the way in which they behaved in that week. The chaos and confusion and level of brutality, which I think were on a different plane compared to leadership spills in the past, I think that owes something to everybody that week. Malcolm Turnbull as well. He took a very high stakes position. We know now that he was contemplating, or he talked out loud about calling an election. We know that he was thinking that the Governor General should refuse to make Peter Dutton Prime Minister. All these things are fascinating aspects of the story, but it shows the way in which Malcolm Turnbull was holding out to the bitter end. And it was Malcolm Turnbull's decision to call the ballot on the Tuesday, I think, a political mistake. I think history shows that those kind of decisions are mistakes, because they've been done before. John Gorton did it in the late 60s, or something similar in the late 60s. So the lesson of history is there. So the blame for that level of brutality is, I think, shared.
I want to ask you quickly about political polling, and particularly the polls in the media. Malcolm Turnbull was the one who really raised the stakes of News Poll by saying that Tony Abbott needed to go because he was approaching and then passed the 30 bad news polls in a row, which then created this standard, which he also fell short of. Do you think that the polling contributed to the chaos, or just reflected what was going on in Canberra?
I think the polling contributed to the chaos. I think it became a tool with which politicians would, I guess, take shots at each other. Turnbull became very exposed because of his own use of News Poll to take down Tony Abbott. And there were moments when all sides were playing the polls. There were moments when Malcolm Turnbull would time an announcement to get a lift in the polls. There were also times, an uncanny correlation between Tony Abbott's major speeches and major headline-grabbing interventions to criticise Turnbull or his policies. And then we'd see that a couple of days later, the pollsters were in the field. So those correlations leave the impression of both sides playing the polling game, because News Poll became the barometer by which Turnbull's leadership was measured. And of course, the big unanswered question, and I admit that I don't have an answer to this because the pollsters have not really adequately explained what was happening with their polling. I don't have an answer as to why the Liberal Party's internal polling was so much more accurate than some of the public polling. There's an argument about the polling that is yet to be had, which requires access to data and, you know, real academic examination, I think, of all of what we saw.
So just finally, David, Scott Morrison at the moment, he's in objectively a pretty good position. He has won the election. He has seen off Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott from the parliament. So those two ghosts are not around to haunt him. Peter Dutton has pretty much said that he's given up any ambition of ever being the Prime Minister as long as Scott Morrison is there. Mr. Morrison is making lots of speeches about ministerial responsibility, asking his ministers to stop talking outside their portfolios and just get on with the job. He's doing well in the polls, if you can believe the polls. It all looks pretty good. But how much hangover from this period that you have written about in Venom is a risk to him, even though he looks to be in a stable position at the moment?
I think the animosity is still there. It's not on display because people have won an election. But I think an election doesn't wipe away all the old feuds. Some of the rivalry is still there. I don't mean by that Peter Dutton steps forward as an alternative Prime Minister. He's declared his loyalty to Scott Morrison. And I think, as you made the point earlier, he's diminished in a sense by some of this activity, some of these events. But I think you can never underestimate the amount of animosity in that party room, because we've seen it in the past and some of it is still there. It can come forward at any time. You never know when something's going to ignite. I've been interested in what's been happening in New South Wales with the abortion debate, because it's got conservatives and moderates within the Liberal Party at each other's throats. 5 months after Gladys Berejiklian won the election, causing strain within that government. Now, that's something that we definitely saw with same-sex marriage under Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull, where social questions had this incredible power to divide a ruling party. So Scott Morrison has significant authority from his election victory. Those around him thought they were going to lose. He remained confident. He's got the protection of leadership rules, where somebody who challenges needs 66% of the vote, not just 50 or 51%. That's an incredible protection. But it doesn't stop some of that animosity. If they can't control that, then they run the risk of having those dysfunctional moments that we've seen in the last parliament. And I don't think that's good for them. It's certainly not good for the country if that happens with a ruling party again.
Well, David, congratulations on the release of Venom. It's a great read. It's a huge achievement to write something like this while also being the chief political correspondent for the Herald and the Age. I don't know how you've done it, but you made it and it's great.
And I'm glad it's done. I'm glad it's out there. Thanks, Tori.
And the next time you're on the pod, we will be sitting on the stage at the Opera House doing a live recording, which will be for listeners on September 1 at 4 p.m. at the Antidote Festival. You can look up tickets in our show notes. Come and see David and me on the stage at the Sydney Opera House. Thanks, David.
Cheers, Tori. See you.
David's book, Venom, Vendettas, Betrayals and the Price of Power, is available now. There's a link to get a copy of it in our show notes. Keep an eye out for our regular program this week, and thanks for listening.